This episode courtesy of Gretsch Drums and that great Gretsch sound. Visit GretschDrums.com to see the latest gear and sign up for the Gretsch newsletter.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Is drummer right? Is it okay to say drummer?
Pounding his pulsing beat into the hearts of all America.
You motherfuckers are fucking all over this joint.
You do your kind of drumming, and I'll do my kind of drumming.
I have no more time. You don't know what I'm up against.
The only things I care about in this goddamn life are me and my drums and you.
The official explanation was he choked on vomit.
You suppose maybe I could put the drums in your place and sort of drop in once in a while?
Now back to Gene Krupa's syncopated style shortly.
Get up there behind those drums, lean back, close your eyes, get right on the groove there, give it a good steady beat.
I got blisters on my fingers!
I'd hit that.
I'm in Austin, Texas, with Tom Breckline. Tom, thank you for having me over today.
Oh, yeah, well, thanks for asking. Of course, man. I'd hit that, right?
I'd hit that.
So there you go. There you go.
We were just talking about how long you've been out here in Texas and everything. I said, let's save it up a little bit and we can get kind of...
Yeah.
Because we can jump around. It's okay. We don't have to go...
Sure.
...chronological order.
Sure, yeah.
You've been out here since 2016.
Well, we moved into the house in November 2016. We've actually officially been here for... Now, this is our sixth year here.
Right.
Our.
Right. Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And it's great here. It's really.
What brought you to Texas? I mean,
well, you know, at the time, I remember, at that time, I don't know how it is now. It could have changed, but studio work was getting light. I mean, I was on the road most of the time, and then local live music was kind of like there weren't very many clubs to play. Like when I first came to Los Angeles, there were tons of places to play, and you could probably pretty much play every night, you know, amongst doing your stuff during the day, you know, if you had some sort of recording thing to do or a jingle or whatever. You know, over the years that got a little slim. I think now there are more places to a little bit more places to play. I don't know what the scene is. I've been away for... I think I went back twice since I've been here. And to work. And it was... I don't know. It was just... It seemed like it was getting lean. You know? And... I remember I came back from... I was doing some stuff in Manhattan and Long Island. And I think it was Long Island mostly, doing some teaching and stuff like that, and some clinics. And
where are you from?
I'm from East Meadow, Long Island, South Shore, Mid Island, Nassau County.
My fellow New Yorker.
11554. Any more information you need? So, 2354 Aberdeen Street.
East Meadow.
There it is.
Shout out to the island. Strong
Island. IV92714. That was
Strong
my
Island.
Hello. East Meadow High School, Woodland Junior High. Yeah.
Yeah, let's back up though. So you were based in New York at one point. I mean, you were there and that's where things began for you. But let's skip to it. Not go back to how did you start? We're over jump ahead to just you get out of high school.
You're like most guys in New York, you start doing what we called club dates, weddings and bar mitzvahs. Mm-hmm. So that was 18, 17, 18, you know, 19, while you're going to Nassau Community College or whatever, you know, and pay for your equipment, your records, and your school. Anyway, so, and then, you know, any other, like, R&B or kind of little jazz gigs you could get. And I was heading my way towards the city. I never got there because this audition with Chick Corea came up.
Now, how does that come up?
Well, I was... there was this great pianist that was on Long Island at the time, and I wanted to
I wanted to learn how to play trio or small group, so I figured rather than go to a drummer, which I should have in retrospect, but I figured, why don't I go with the piano player and what they would... They would know what they want, the drummer behind the solos, behind the whatever. You know, accompaniment. Mm-hmm. So we go and we just basically sit in his living room with my drum set and his piano, and we play duo. You know, and then he'd hit me to these Bill Evans records and stuff. Well, anyway, he was doing a record with Stanley Clark. Oh, yeah. No, he got his first synthesizer, and he got hooked up with Stanley Clark. And, so he got this. I remember he had the Korg, one of the first Korg synthesizers. It looked like just like a strip with keyboards on it. And he says, "Tommy, can you just stay a little bit and let's play a little?" Okay, so we basically did sort of quasi pseudo what you call fusion-esque Latin. I know that's a blanket statement, you know, rock or whatever, you know, and. So we started playing, and I knew all about that, and I knew how to swing as well, and we just started burning, improvising, and we were playing off of each other, and I was like, it was 19 going on 20 at the time, and he was looking at me, and he goes, "I didn't know you played like that." I said, "Well, I'm not here to play that, I'm here to learn this, you know," and so he had a boombox at the time for... Look up Google boombox for those of you who don't know what a boombox is. So you, then he recorded it on cassette, and then he ended up doing the Modern Man album for Stanley Clark, and he was going over to L.A. and he says when he came back, he says, "You know, I mentioned you to Chick because he was friends with Chick, and I also mentioned you to Stanley." And I think I was trying to get in with Randy and Michael Brecker too, and I heard that was kind of in the wind too, but I wasn't sure. I can't really say that for sure, but and there was some other thing. Oh yeah, the Silver Connection, "Fly Robin Fly." You know, at that time disco was big. You know, yeah. So I just wanted to get in. I wanted to go into Manhattan and starve with the rest of my buddies. Because in a loft, so you could play all night. So, and I wanted to quit school too. So anyway, he recommended me to Chick, and then he said, "You know, you should put a demo together." So I said, "Okay." So another buddy, a great keyboard player, his name is Peter Zinsmeister. He played with the Turtles later on. He goes under the name of Peter Z, and he's in Arizona, and a great keyboard player. He said, "Well, listen, man, why don't we put a group together? Maybe we can open for some bands at the Bottom Line, so we make a little demo." I said, "Okay, that's great." So we chipped in. We went to, what was the name? It was a studio in Franklin. And anyway, it was on Franklin Avenue. And anyway, and I just... Never mind. I'm going to go to the incoherent.
Yeah,
I'm going to do a lot of editing on this.
Yeah.
And so we did that, but that never made it to Chick. What made it to Chick was the boombox jam.
So how long are we talking from that jam until Chick? Like,
it was a couple of weeks.
Okay.
Because Chick was going to be in town. Chick was coming through town.
Oh, so Chick, yeah, he wasn't living in New York.
No, he was living in L.A. He just moved to L.A.
Mm-hmm.
So, then I got a call from Chick's office saying that Chick's going to be in town and he'd like to hear you play. So, Mike, who was the piano player, we did it at his house, which is the first time I've seen Chick play live. Was when I was auditioning for him. So, there were three bass players. It was Ken Smith, Anthony Jackson, and Rick Laird.
That you played with that day?
Yes, 6 hours. And
they're rotating. They're coming in, leaving.
Right, and I'm there.
You're the drummer. He's checking out bass players.
And he's just, you know, I mean, any of those bass players.
I mean, he's clearly checking you out as well, but
I didn't know that at the time. I just went, you know, I don't know who else he had in mind, you know. So we did stuff from the Mad Hatter, of which I attained through Mike Garson. Test pressing of Mad Hatter. So I knew all the other stuff.
And you're 20 years old at this point?
Oh, yeah. I just turned 20.
How old is Chick at this point?
Chick? I think we had his 30th birthday on the road.
Okay. So maybe 10 years older than you, let's say.
Yeah, about 10 years old.
Okay.
I think we're 35th. I don't know which.
Okay.
I think.
Yeah, not sure. I got you.
You know?
But he was the old vet.
Yeah. He was definitely older than me.
Yeah.
And all the other guys were, too. And So what we did, and Friends was still in the can. In other words, not mixed. It was still, you know, so that he only had rough mixes of that. And I didn't have that. I just had the test pressing of it. So the first thing we did was the one step. And which is just, we started out on with the tune called the one step, which is the first tune on the Friends record. We did that, and that went good, you know. I mean, I was ready to play all this stuff, and here's a simple da-do-ding, da-do-da. Okay, so then we did that, and then there was another tune called Cappuccino on that record. And that was sort of a thing that went, just bear with my singing, it was like, bam, sort of like Elvin type stuff, you know, McCoy type stuff. So there's this part in the middle that goes bum bum da da, and you kind of solo over it, da 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 da, bang bang bang, sort of quasi do something over that while the melody goes, but never mind, never mind. But so I did that, and I said, oh God, I really sucked on that one, you know. And then we did the vamp to Dear Alice, which is just basically goes boom boom ta ka boom boom ta ba, and it's do 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 boom boom ta ka ta boom boom, you know. And so we just jammed off of that, and then we did a tune called Sicily. Which is sort of like a quasi-samba deal. And so we did that. That was off the Friends record, too. And I remember there's a coda on Sicily that goes, 1, 2, 3, 4. Right? So I remember he played some of the rough mixes for me. He played that, and you can hear that in the coda. You know, Steve Gadd was, he still is, he was God back then, to me as well, you know. But he flubbed, I mean, as far as flubbing goes, it wasn't even a flub, it was just a hesitation. And I remember Chick looked up at me and went, what, Steve Gadd make a mistake? And then I went like, holy crap. And it wasn't a mistake. And you can hear it if you listen to the record. That part that goes da 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 da, that part of the coda. And it's just a little snare drum. It's a micro minuscule snare drum. Not even a flub. I'd say it would be very innovative. So it kind of made me feel better at the point, because I thought after the day was done, I figured, oh God, I don't think I got this. I don't think I had this gig at all. Or I didn't know what I was in for.
You didn't think it went well.
Yeah. I said it went okay. So then, you know, Chick says, he goes, I'll talk to you soon, Tom. And I'm like, oh, well, I'll hang on to that, you know. So been about, I don't know if it was 2 weeks later or a week later, you know, Chick was coming through and playing the first time Herbie and Chick were going out as a piano duet.
And I remember I was skipping string class because I was doing music education. You had to take classes, whatever.
Right, right, right.
In each of the instruments. And I ditched it. That was with my girlfriend. And my mom called me up and said, because we just had rotary phones and touched on this. Says, Chicoria's office just called. You know, I was like, you better get your ass over here. So I got a free pass to go to Carnegie Hall to watch Chick and Herbie play. And so I went and sat in a box seat with all these people, the management and everything. And nobody's telling me anything.
Who's on drums?
There's nobody on drums. It was just piano duets.
Gotcha.
Piano duets. And everybody was there to see the duets. McLaughlin was there, Dave Liebman, to name a few. And I'm like freaking out. I'm going, here are all my heroes. They're here. And I'm like, I'm just this ho-dunk from East Meadow, you know. And so then they asked me to come again tomorrow. And I hung out the whole day with Chick. And at the time, Ron Moss was the manager. And he was just laughing because nobody was telling me anything. You know, and you know, I'm 20 years old, man. I mean, it's like there he is, the icon. You know, it's like, and you're, I'm going, so what's going on? You know, so that night we're watching the second night we're watching the gig, and they take like a 15-minute intermission. You know. So somebody says, you know, Chick wants to talk to you. So I said, oh, this might be the moment. So I go backstage, and he goes to me, he goes, Tommy, do you live close to here? And of course I said, yeah, even if I lived 2 hours away, I would say, yeah. He says, could you bring your drums to this address so we can play a little bit more? And I went, sure. So while they did the second half, I drove from Carnegie Hall back to Long Island, put the drums in the car.
He meant that night.
Yeah, that night. My Delta 88, you know. And zipped on back, got some cheap parking, and it was the dead of winter. It was, oh my God. And I mean, anyway, so, and I dragged my drums into this place, and who's there? Jeff Berlin's there on bass. So we do the same spiel, the whole thing, you know. We do the coda for Sicily, and of course Jeff's nailing everything, you know. And I'm going, well, definitely Jeff got the gig. I mean, I definitely, because then we were in a little room back there where you could see. There were no doors there, but it was a room back there talking to Jeff, and he's not talking to me. So I went, okay, well, there you go, you know. So when I was packing up my stuff, Chick was leaving, and he's still not saying anything. And he says, listen, I'll call you in about 10 days, something like that. I got the rest of the stuff with Herbie to do, and whatever. So on February 10th, to make a long story short, after I shoveled snow 3 times, and since we only had one phone in the house, and I told my sisters, who were older than me, I said, if you're going to get a call, make it short. I'm expecting a phone call. Right? The make it short. This is the youngest kid in the family saying that to me. Yeah. So, for those who question, my dad died when I was 10, and we all pulled together as a family to keep everything going, my mom and my 2 sisters. So that's why we were all at home. And as well, my mom had a job too. So, but anyway, So after shoveling snow 3 times, I mean, it was one of the worst snowstorms ever. 10 o'clock, February 10th at 10 o'clock at night, and it's Chick. And I'm going, okay, here we go. It's going to be thanks. Seriously, this is not false modesty. This is exactly what was going through my head. I was like, I guess he's going to say, well, good job, kid, but, you know, better luck next time. And he said it just like this. He goes, Tommy, it's Chick. I said, and I went, yeah, Chick. He said, so listen, would you like to come on the road with me? And I was like, you know, I got really calm. And I just went, yeah, sure. He goes, well, I'm going to have the tour manager, Dave Brett's, call up. And you're going to need some cases. We'll get that all handled for you, like the Anvil cases or whatever. We'll get that all handled for you. And we start in match in March. And he goes, there's a few things I want you to listen to. And I said, sure. He says, check out A Love Supreme. And check out some Tito Puente records. And what else? Oh, yeah, Eddie Palmieri. Which is exactly what I did. And he said, okay, man, welcome aboard. Click. And then I waited a second and I screamed to high heaven. And I remember, you know, back in those days, you know, you had those little Cape Cod houses. I don't know if they had them in Westchester County, but, you know, you walk in the door and there's a little, I guess you call it a foyer or whatever, you know, it's a little landing here. And then you'd have the steps that would go upstairs. And then to the right, it's the living room. And that's where the phone stand would be, right near the front door, you know, with the only phone. And here's some of my mom. I remember my girlfriend at the time was in there with the rest of the family. And we used to have fights about me quitting school and I wanted to go to Manhattan and live. And so when I said I had the gig, I remember I was sitting there just like, what just happened? And meanwhile, people were going, everybody was talking in the room and she came over to me. And nobody noticed it. And she whispered in my ear. After I told her I got the gig, I said, I got the gig. And she went, she whispered in my ear, and she goes, now I know why. Meaning, now I know why you didn't want to go to, you didn't want to complete school. You wanted to get out, and you wanted to go into Manhattan and everything that you wanted. It was a really nice moment, but it was just between us.
Yeah.
And it was really, really great. That's one of the biggest pleasure moments of my life. I mean, endearing, you know, heartfelt moments, that moment. And then just things started going after that, you know.
Because how long did that go on for?
I worked with Chick for like on and off for 3 to 5 years, that between 78 up until 83. And then I started working with Joe Farrell, and then I went on to work with Wayne Shorter.
So just hold on, just to back up, when you start with Chick, and this is touring, you're going...
Yeah, the first tour, I'd never been on a plane before.
So where were you, Europe, or was it...
Europe, Australia, Japan, 3 months.
Interesting.
And ended up in Hawaii, and then we did a festival tour. We did Newport Jazz Festival at the Fort Adams, and, you know, the original Newport Jazz Festival. We did the Hollywood Bowl. We did Saratoga, New York. We did all those. And, so being on a plane, I got my mileage. You know, so it was definitely culture shock just coming out. Because back then, you know, New York and Los Angeles were two different planets. As, you know, this is 1978. And I remember coming into Los Angeles in March. I think it was March 13th or something like that. And then being on the bus, going to get picked up, you know, I had my luggage, got all the stuff. And I remember it must have been in the mid-60s. And to us, before we moved to Los Angeles, that's warm weather. That's just, it's to us. And everybody's wearing jackets and stuff. And I'm going, my blood hadn't been thinned out enough yet. I'm going, what's with these people? They're wearing jackets. It's not even cold out, you know? So it was really... And Los Angeles and Hollywood was like... I was like, wow, look at this. This is... I mean, I knew Manhattan. Manhattan was wow to me, but this was like a whole different scene, culture. You know? And, yeah, it was just... It was definitely a culture shock. And then we went to rehearse... the big stage at SIR and on Sunset, and we did that for a week, I think. And it was the 13-piece band. It had full horns, it had a string quartet,
and Dave Liebman playing, and the horn section was Al Vizzuti, Glenn Zatola, Jim Pugh, who now plays with Steely Dan, you know, who's been playing with Steely Dan for a long time, among other things, and Ron Moss played trombone, and then they had Charlie Veal, who did a lot of studio work in Los Angeles on violin. Paula Hochhalter, another one. She also played in the Visions of the Emerald Beyond Mahavishnu Orchestra. And Judy Geist was on viola. And Paula Hochhalter, who did a lot of studio work in Los Angeles, was on cello. And we did everything from the original Return to Forever, the Light as a Feather, Return to Forever type thing, to the three solo records that Chick did, like in the 70s, which was Leprechaun by Spanish Heart and Manhattan. And we did stuff with the Friends record. Then we as an encore, we did Duel of the Jester and the Tyrant from the Romantic Warrior record. So it was a full, definitely trial by fire in every way, you know. And I learned, I'll tell you, but I learned a lot that year, and I remember Bernie Kirsch, who engineered all those records. Great engineer. Engineered those three solo records and also Friends. It was Dennis Bakai that engineered Romantic Warrior, and I worked with him as well later on. But Bernie is an incredible engineer.
Dennis Mackay?
Dennis Mackay.
Yeah, I had him on. The British guy? No.
What's that?
No. I think he was on the show. I think I've had him on the show.
Oh, no, he passed away a long time ago.
Who in hell am I thinking of? Anyway.
Anyway. No, he's a British guy. He's kind of like Dudley Moore, man. He was kind of like...
Did he produce Judas Priest?
Yes, he did.
He was on the show.
Oh, he was on the show?
Look, first of all, this show's been around for 10 years.
Oh, because the last project they did for him... was Al Di Meola Tiramisu.
I didn't know he passed away.
What's that?
I didn't know.
Oh, yeah, he passed away shortly after that. That was 1988, 89.
Wait a minute. No.
Maybe there was another. No, he engineered the Judas Priest records. He didn't produce them, from what I understand. Maybe he got the producer. But Dennis Mackay.
Oh, I'm very confused, brother. I don't know
when he passed away. But either the late 80s or the early 90s, he passed away. But not in the aughts. I don't. Maybe I'm wrong.
It's okay. But
I'll have to Google it.
It's got to be the same guy. It has to be. British.
Yeah. He did. Kind of like Dudley Moore, you know.
Yeah, it's got to be.
This is Tom Munich, but he uses all that tape on your tom-toms, are you?
It's got to be the same guy. Anyway.
And every time he'd mess with me, I'd go, Tom. Like, I didn't know. The first one was a session for Mike Miller, and Mike got it. And I remember the first time I met him, he goes, Tom, give me some bass drum. And I go, boom. He goes, no, the bass drum, Tom. And he goes, no, the bass. No, I need bass drum, Tom. And then he started laughing. And I said, you. He did the same thing on the Di Meola record. And did that at Power Station. And what a beautiful sound he got on drums.
Well, let me ask you something. So when you go out, you're 20 years old, back to that, you're going out with Chick.
Yeah.
You're making real bread, I take it.
Yeah, good bread. You know, this is my first gig, so I got paid well.
In other words, I'm just trying to, like, look at it from that angle of a 20-year-old. That's really
what... Oh, hell yeah.
I'm coming from that angle.
Oh, yeah.
Of, like, can we just talk about that for a minute? Being a kid, and there's, like, your first real gig, making real bread. What is that like? Like, what do you...
Oh, it's great, but it's, like, my financial at that time... You know, it was all about playing, so...
Yeah.
I was like...
Are you just storing it up in a bag? I mean, what's going
on? Oh, well, my wife can tell you about that when she first met me. It's like, oh, my God. I don't want to talk about that, really.
You don't want to talk...
I mean, but I saved my money, and it was fine.
No, but just that idea, again, about it being a kid.
Yeah, well, I was already making money as a musician doing, like, weddings and bar mitzvahs and the odd gigs, you know?
Sure, and they're probably paid the same that they do today, I bet.
The weddings and bar mitzvahs?
Yeah.
I have no idea. I swear to God, I have no idea.
I'm saying you made a few hundred bucks probably back then doing weddings and bar mitzvahs.
Oh well, yeah, but
that's what they pay today. Is my point.
Oh, that's all they. Oh, they pay them today. Okay.
The pay hasn't changed. Oh, is what I'm saying.
I remember the band leader going, and we were the most popular band in Steve and Scott Music because we played all the disco stuff and we played all the Stevie Wonder stuff and we played all the, you know.
Right, right.
As well as the standards. And.
But what I'm saying is, so do you, I mean, you're on the road, I get it, you're out, you don't have time, but is this where you say, I'm going to get my own place now in the city? Like, is it that kind of thing?
Yeah, I was in a transition point there to do that, but both my sisters were gone. And I said, I want to live in the city. And my mom goes, well, why don't you live here? I said, oh, well, I said, she goes, so what I did is I helped out with my mother the last, you know, and I was already making a transition. So the good part about, so this is where we go, how I came to L.A. We had already done a record called Secret Agent and another record called Tap Step. And I was still living on Long Island at the time. So now we were getting ready to do this next record, which would have been Touchstone, which I didn't end up on anyway, but I ended up doing the tour. So I came out, and then Al Vizzuti and Bunny Brunell had a band together. Al Vizzuti's an incredible trumpet player. Bunny Brunell's a great bass player. You know, that's who ended up on Chick's band after Rick Laird. I forgot to say the 13-piece band Rick Laird was playing. So when we did Secret Agent, that's when Bunny came into the picture. So so we were about to do this third record, which was supposed to be a third record. And then so I was doing gigs with them, and just until I wasn't even thinking of getting a place. So here I am, I'm making money, I'm doing stuff, and I'm crashing out on a friend's couch. And then they let me put my drums and stuff in their apartment. You know, and then we eventually got it. And then we eventually all, the three of us, the guys, you rent a house together, you know.
In LA.
So that, yeah, in Los Angeles. And
so you just kind of ended up there. Like, you didn't really
ended up there.
Yeah, you didn't technically move. You just sort of.
No, it's because that's where the work took me, as like there, and I ended up there.
And then you get more work, and you just.
Well, it was kind of lean the first, you know, because you're thinking that, you know, they're a lot smarter people than me at that age, at that time. And, so even though I did have some money, you know, I'm. Well, with these three other guys, I didn't even have a car yet, you know, and I just happened into this thing, and I started getting work on the East Coast, going back work on the East Coast, and then the West Coast, and then I go to Europe with Chick or something like that, or, you know, do a U.S. tour with Chick at the time, and that would keep me busy. Then I started doing club work. It was pretty lean the first year I was there. Because it doesn't matter who you work with. It really doesn't, unless you're being seen in town by these people. Word gets out. That, at least at that time. Well, that's my case. Everybody's story is different. Unless you're doing that, it's starting all over again. You just don't come to town. Like, yeah, I work with Chick Corea. Yeah, hire me, you know. You got to deliver the goods. So eventually, like anything, it got better and better and better. Plus the fact I didn't want to live there. You know? But what happened was, he gave me an open-end ticket. Oh, that's right. No, I moved back and forth. For like, oh, man, it's really crazy. I was there. I ended up there. And then I think it was the last tour I did with Chick. That's when I officially ended up in Los Angeles. Because I was going back and forth. And I think the last thing was, is I was playing with Al Vizzuti, and I was at his house. And Chick said to me, he says, well, we're going to postpone this record because I want to do an all-star record with Steve Gadd and Michael Brecker and Eddie Gomez. And that became a three quartets record, of which me and Bunny and I and Steve Gajala did the demos for. So I got to actually play that music for the first time over at the Mad Hatter studio, which was just opened, his studio at the time. And we played through that stuff. So anyway, so he says, well, you have an open-end ticket, so you can go back home if you want to. So I opted to go back home, check it out. I think that was the time I had to just, you know, tie up some loose ends anyway. And then for this next tour, I had to come back. I think it was still 1981, something like that. And so I went out for the tour at that point, and that's when I ended up in Los Angeles. Does that make sense? I'm just trying to think of this. And then I just happened to be there. And again, with my same old friends, I went back to the house, rented the house, and I mean, between the three of us, and ended up in L.A., and then you know, eventually got a car, met my wife, and that's when I met my wife, I think it was 1982, and that went fast. I asked her to marry me on the third date, and we'll be married for 40 years this August 27th. She was born in Borneo.
Borneo?
Yeah, in Malaysia.
Yeah, I just had to say it again to make sure I
heard
that
correctly. Yeah, she was born in Borneo, in Malaysia.
I mean, I always think of the wild man from Borneo.
Yeah, you're right.
That's...
But, and her father was Scottish.
Now, have you been? Has she gone back? Has she...
No, not recently. No, it has been a while, but her mom has come over. Her mom is great. She's a tiny little... Malaysian woman with a Scots accent mixed with a Malaysian accent. It's fantastic. She's great. I got more, you know, I got lucky. I mean, that sounds like a cliche, but it's true. I really got lucky. So, anyway. So when I left Chick's band, she started working.
Now, what do you mean you left Chick's? Yeah, let's get, why?
Well, I didn't leave. I mean, okay. I thought it was time to move on for me. And, he intimated that, you know, I mean, I don't know if that's how it went, but I remember he was kind of thinking of the Electric Band. I'm not saying that this happened, but this is just what I equated to. He says, Tommy, I want to put a band together, and I know I want you to play drums, but I don't know who else I want in the band. And I was kind of like, I wouldn't say disinterested, but I guess I didn't show enough enthusiasm about it. Because I wanted to move on, and I mean, at that time, you know, not every young person does that, but you know, it's not that I was cocky or whatever, it's just like, well, maybe I should explore some other things and still, you know. And, which is, in hindsight, I mean, who would want to quit Chick's band, you know? So, I mean, I didn't quit, you know, but it was sort of like, and then later on, what happened is he got the Electric Band together. And then I started working with Joe Farrell, and then shortly after that, got the gig with Wayne Shorter. And then he put the Electric Band together in 84. So, and then from time to time, with the Acoustic Band, when Dave couldn't make it, he called me up and we'd play, we'd have a good, really good time. And I had played with John before, John Patitucci with Joe Farrell. And that's how that Got a Match tune came about. You know, you familiar with that tune? Because Joe would say three things, not in the particular order. He'd call me Tommy. He'd say, Tommy, got a cigarette? Got a match? What time is it? Like that. He used to talk like this. Tommy, what are you doing? You know, that kind of thing. And then when Patitucci calls me every once in a while, he calls me up, he goes, Tommy, what are you doing? You know, because we all played with Joe. I mean, different, me, Kayakagi, Patitucci, and then later on, wonderful bass player, Bob Harrison. And then we became the quartet after that. And but I remember one time, we were playing at this club called Dante's. I don't know if you remember Dante's. It was on Lancashire Boulevard. And I remember we were like putting our stuff together, and you know, Joe's got his, you know, saxophone there, his hat, and his cigarette with a little Nicorette
cigarette holder.
And go like that, you know, smoked sunglasses, and you know, with the beard and everything, looking really hip. You know, we're setting up our stuff, and he goes, Tommy, got a cigarette? And then Kay would go, what time is it? And he goes, And then John would go, got a match? And he'd get pissed off. He goes, oh, I said, well, you say that, you know, didn't matter what order it was. So we told Chicks, John and I knew Chick. I said, yeah, Joe, it's great playing with Joe, man. He's always goes, Chummy, got a match? Got a cigarette? What time is it? You know, but he would say, that's right, he'd say, Tony, got a match? And I'd say, what time is it? And then Kay would say, you know, got a cigarette? Because he just do that constantly. That's one of the great moments. The other tune that Chick wrote called Charged Particles is from Joe as well, the title. Because I remember telling Chick the story. We were at a rehearsal with Joe Farrell. And he goes, Tommy, I think I got a name for our band. I go, well, what do you want to call it, Joe? He goes, Charged Particles. Because I like the sound of that. Charged Particles. That's the way he said it. So I told Chick about it, and he laughed. And then before they did that record, I believe, it's called Beneath the Mask, I think, Joe had passed away. And that was in... So he wrote, in honor of Joe, he wrote this tune called Charged Particles. So for anybody who's interested, I know it's a long-winded story. Like everything I'm saying here. But it's like... that's how that title came about. You know? So
you're in town. Are you doing, at that point, like you mentioned before, jingles and this kind of stuff. Are you doing session studio work? Are you doing...
Well, I started doing... I mean, I was there... How long was I there for before I started doing... You know, I do like what was called scab session work.
Mm-hmm.
And some session work, you know, but for people's projects and stuff like that. And then I got hooked up with the South American contingency where they paid cash all the time. But played really good money. And a lot of people did them. Tristan Bowden. We played with a lot of great players. Like Grant Geisman, Jimmy Johnson. I think I got on the first one through Jimmy Johnson. For those of you who don't know who Jimmy Johnson, he's playing with James Taylor right now. Jimmy Johnson and I met in 1978. We were doing a fusion project for Doc Severinsen, which Jeff Tysik and Al Vizzuti produced. And he was working with Henry Mancini at the time. That was 1978. That was when I believe he just came to town from Minnesota. He was playing with Henry Mancini, and he was one of the first guys to use a 5-string bass. He had that 5-string Alembic back then. I said, who is this guy? And another guy named John Goo, who's a great guitar player, has done tons of sessions. I was still living on Long Island. Those were the days where you could put a complete drum set underneath the plane if you bypass the check-in counter and slipped Skycap like 10 or 20 bucks. Your trap kit, everything would go on the plane.
Yeah.
And they'd make sure to get on the plane for no extra cost, you know. Anyway, so, what was it? Was it Wilshire Sound? I can't remember. It was a new studio at the time. Anyway, so, yeah, that's the first time I met Jimmy. And then we also did some stuff for Doc with the, not the London Symphony, I think it was the London Philharmonic or something like that, at Olympic Studios where the Stones recorded.
Right.
We rehearsed in where the Stones recorded, then we did it in the big room. That was great.
Who were the guys, though, like as far as drummers, when at that time, who were considered like the first call guys, like guys that you were thinking like, oh man, I just gotta...
Harvey Mason. The first one that comes to mind is Harvey Mason, definitely. John Garin was still doing a lot of stuff. Vinny was just getting on the scene. He was still playing with Zappa, I think. But yeah, he was definitely, you know. John Ferraro. John Robinson first started coming in. He was still playing with Rufus, I believe. My good buddy, the Rockford Files. It'll come to me. Well, Gary Ferguson, another guy. I'm probably missing, like, some of the...
But Harvey Mason is, like, that's interesting. That's one of the first names that comes to you.
Well, I was doing... Still didn't have a car yet. I got paid, and I got to... You're talking about first call guys in L.A., right? Talking about first... Art Rodriguez was another guy. He's great. But Harvey Mason, we were doing... I was doing a session for Osama Kitajima. He had asked me to play on his record. He's a Koto player. And I brought my drums down. You know, I didn't have cartage back then. Those guys had cartage. So I knew Harvey was on the morning sessions. So I put my drums in the hallway. What was the name of that? Paramount. It's called Paramount Recorders, and it was on...
That's it.
Anyway, Paramount Recorders. It was near SIR Santa Monica Boulevard in Hollywood. So I walk in there, and there's Harvey, and he's playing these Tiger Eye Yamaha drums. And he's playing in a pair of cowboy boots. And he's playing his ass off. And the sound was just incredible. Because I wanted to watch him work. You know, he was one of my heroes. And I just wanted to watch him work. And I was like, God, the sound is incredible. I mean, he's playing, and he's playing in cowboy boots, you know? And he's kicking ass, you know? So, of course, when you the new guy in town, you know, the producer, they looked at me like, okay, who's this guy? You know, the engineer, you know, the Los Angeles type of baloney that was going on at the time.
Yeah.
It's like, who are you? You know, so I was just standing there, you know what I mean? I guess Harvey had heard of me or something. And right in front of me, both the producer and the engineer go, Harvey, can you make the afternoon sessions? I said, I'm already booked for this. These guys were ready to, like, blow me off. And Harvey looked at me and he said, but he looked at the guys and goes, I'm sure Tom can handle the afternoon sessions quite well, you know? And I never forgot that. And then later on, we were doing a Carlos Vega memorial concert thing, and we were on the panel and stuff like that. And I remember I went up there and did a double shuffle for the students and stuff, and you could hear Harvey going, yeah, you know? And then he patted me on the back, and this was years later. This was, I don't know, 2010 or something. And I took him aside. I said, Harvey, you know, I got to tell you, you're a class act. And not only are you my hero, but do you remember what you did? I reminded him of that day. And he said, oh, man, gave me a big hug, and that was it. But it's nice to remind those guys of what they did for you. I mean, Harvey is, not only is he an incredible musician, but he's number one class act. He really is. As well as Rick Murata, Jerry, Steve, Gad, and they've all been really, Chris Parker, they've all been nice to me. Bernard Purdy, I mean, Al Foster is another one. These guys have been really, and when they give you an acknowledgement, it's just heaven. It's just like, it's your little badge that you put, you wear, you know, and it's to name a few, you know, these guys are really something, you know. I remember one time I was playing, and Dugu, Dugu's the same one. He really supported, you know, he was really behind me 1,000%. But I remember we did this double drum thing, you know, the Yamaha Groove Night. We played an Earth, Wind & Fire ballad, and Dugu said to Joe Testa, who was running the thing at the time, he goes, okay, we got to do some double drum. Who do you want to play with? And Dugu says, I want to play with Tom. And then when he said, yeah, great, you know, and then Dugu looks at me, he goes, come on in here. And we get into his car, and he goes, what do you think about playing a ballad? And I went, sure. So we played an Earth, Wind & Fire ballad. And I remember when we played, it was a moment First of all, he said something to me that was hilarious. I'm not going to say it. I'll tell you after the interview. You know, to get a little bit more deeper in the pocket. And he was smiling at me. And then Steve Gadd and Rick Moran, those guys were on the side of the stage. And I remember not only was just, I mean, first of all, it was a Dugu I was sitting next to. You know, we were playing together. It's like, you know, it doesn't get any better than that, you know. And when I got off stage, there was Steve. He goes, come here, you knucklehead. And he gave me noogies on the head, you know. I said, well, yeah, there you go, you know. Life's good, you know. It's like, you know, that was, I don't know which groove night that was, but that it was great. I had a total blast. I did about three of them.
How did you get to know Carlos Vega?
Carlos, I was playing at the Baked Potato. And he came up to me. He goes, hey, man, maybe we could share some gigs together. I said, sure. You know, I mean, but nothing ever came of it. But still, because at the time, I knew Carlos, but I didn't know him that well, you know. And he was a great guy. As Jeff, I was at Sunset Sound when I first met Jeff.
Were you playing?
I was playing. And Jeff, I was just kind of warming up. You know, I set my own stuff up because the session was the next day, and I just futzing around. And
so he came in and he heard you.
Yeah, and he says, man, you sound great, man. He says, I'm Jeff. I said, Jeff Porcaro? Yeah. I says, this was early on, you know. Jeff had already established himself, but to me, everything was... That was 1980, I believe. And... or 79 or something. And he, right after he said that, we had a little discussion. He goes, come on, I want to introduce you to some people. He was doing a Melissa Manchester record next door, and he introduced me to everybody in the studio. The contractor, the producer, he goes, wait, I'll be right back. And he goes into the studio. He's playing those blonde Gretsch drums. One take, it was perfect. And then we went back and we hung out a little bit. Like he did it like
Hold on a second.
I gotta have a cup of coffee. So he did that, you know. And Carlos was the same way. He's just really gentlemanly, you know. And just both of them were just really incredible. And it was a great loss. It really was, because not only were these guys monster musicians, and you know, there's all these stories going around, whatever, but they were. They were great people. They were really great people, and I'm proud to have known them. And you know, like and the guys who are still alive, you know. So another one was Bernard Purdy. I remember with the damn show. I was about to leave to go to a gig. He goes, "Hey Tom, what are you doing?" I said, "I gotta leave, man." He says, "Come here." And he gave me a kiss on the head. He goes, stay out of trouble. I said, I certainly will. So I got anointed that night, that day, you know. I thought that was great, you know.
I was sick.
And, you know, Chris Parker. I used to see Steve and Chris play with Stuff when they first got that band together. When they moved from playing at McKell's to playing at the Bottom Line. And they go in there early and then buy two tickets. My hard-earned club date money and park across the street, which is now where NYU is. It used to be a vacant lot where you could pay $10 and stay there the whole night, and there was hardly anybody that parked in there. And then the Tower Records was across the street, and I used to go saw them. I saw Steve so many times, and Chris and Rick Murata played with John Tropea at McKell's. I mean, and then after that, you could go to Sweet Basil's and see Al Foster play, you know, with Jack Wilkins and Eddie Gomez. And it was great. For the price of a beer, you could sit at the bar and just watch these guys play. It was a great time, you know, as you hear everybody say, it was a great time back in the 60s. It was a great time back in the 70s. But they were all great times. It was great. New York City was killer back then. And L.A. was, too, in retrospect. Even though I didn't... It took me 5 years to get used to L.A. Until finally... I was already married a year, I think. And I was coming back from a recording session. Saw the sunset. I was living in Burbank then. And I said, okay, this is home. That's when, you know, a lot more stuff started happening. I know I'm going here and here and here and here.
No, it's fine. That's
a strut. You know?
Sure, sure.
So, but yeah, it's been great. And then coming out here is the topping on the cake, you know.
Were there opportunities that came up that you just, it couldn't happen because of scheduling, things like, you know. Big smile on his face.
Well, the biggest one was, Steve Perry will kill me for talking about this too. I was rehearsing with Wayne Shorter. We were going for the, this is when we had, it was Al Di Meola opening up, you know, solo acoustic. Then us with Wayne. And then the Chick Corea Electric Band. We did a whole tour. And then we went off to do our own tours separately. So there was one tour where, this one thing where we played the Greek Theater in Berkeley. It was one of the worst, I thought it was one of the worst gigs of my life with Wayne. But, and we played there in the afternoon, and then we headed back to Los Angeles the same day. And I'm going, oh, jeez, you know, what the, you know what, fill in the blank. And so we go back, and then the next morning, there's a phone call on the answering machine. Remember those? And it's Steve Perry. Oh, no, oh, let me do a preamble to that. The preamble to that was a, whatever you want to call it, is we're rehearsing for this tour coming up. And we just got a new keyboard player. This is where Mitch Foreman came into the band. Tom Candy was playing. And for whatever reasons, couldn't make that tour. So we were looking for people, and nothing was meshing. For some reason, Wayne wasn't happy with the choices that we made for people. We got everybody. So anyway, finally he got Mitch Foreman. So we had like only like... Mitch, there was a lot of stuff in that music. And it was all on the keyboards, really. And so Mitch had to learn that in about 2 or 3 days, so we had these rehearsals. So anyway, I came home from one rehearsal, and I found out through Mitch that Danny Gottlieb auditioned for Journey. And here's where you can edit all this stuff. It's like, and I had never thought of auditioning, so I came home and I told my wife, and I said, yeah, Danny auditioned for Journey, you know, Danny, I hope he gets the gig. And she goes to me, my wife, she goes, well, why don't you call him up? I said, and just as a joke, I said, nah, let them call me. Well, that's what happens. You know, now we're back to Berkeley, and I don't think I played good. And I come home, and then it's Steve Perry on the phone. And I thought it was Mitch playing a game, playing a joke. He says, Narada Michael Walden saw you at the thing, and he says, you're just a guy for us. You know, so send me some of your stuff, and I'll FedEx. Here's our FedEx and blah blah blah. I'll know within 5 minutes if you should come down and play. So I didn't respond to the first one, but the second one I did respond to because he called again, and then that's when he told me all that stuff. So apparently Michael Walden saw me at that gig, and
which is interesting, full circle, considering he ended up
right. Well, considering too, he's my hero. Apocalypse and Visions of the Emerald Beyond.
Well, that's real. I mean, again, yeah, to have everyone vouching for you—that's amazing. Yeah.
So this is 1985, 86.
Steve Smith has just left.
Yeah, Steve Smith has just left. So they hired Mike Baird.
That's right. That's right.
But apparently, I don't know what happened. So then they were, I heard they were auditioning everybody.
Oh, so this is post-Baird.
This is post-Baird. This is the first post-Baird.
Gotcha.
And then Michael ended up getting the gig anyway.
Is this also with Randy Jackson?
Yes. And I met Randy Jackson, too. This is the Raised on the Radio record. Because Lonnie London, he passed away.
Larry London, right. Larry London.
My apologies, Larry London.
Great shirts.
Yeah. And he played friggin' great on the record. I mean, he's amazing. Yeah. And he had a heart attack. So he was, you know, so anyway, so I put a tape together. I think we had done demos with Robin or something. Or there was a live thing. And I put together something real quick. And then I sent it out on a DAT tape. And that night he says, "You gotta come." Like, and we had to do this. I think it was a 3-week tour. This is with that combination chick, Al, Wayne, and Chick tour. So what I did through that whole tour, you know, I used to hang out after the gigs. You know, we were doing sheds. We were doing a shed tour with that combination. It went great. Everybody played. It was really always a great night of music. But I wouldn't hang out afterwards. And what I'd do is I'd go back to my room and air drum and write and transcribe parts out. Because, you know, they're used to the parts that they hear, you know. Play air drums every night for about maybe an hour or two before hitting the hay. And because people thought it was strange I wasn't hanging, because I hang out all the time, you know. And so I made up a story on the day. We had about 2 or 3 days off. I think we were in St. Louis. And so I had a ticket from St. Louis to San Francisco. And I told everybody, because I didn't want anybody to know what I was doing, because, you know, you don't want to jinx it also, or whatever, for whatever reasons. You know, I didn't want anybody, you know, because whatever. You don't get it, you don't get it. That's okay. Tell them afterwards. So I told everybody I was going to, it was a death in the family. Where do you got to go? You can't hang out? I was like, it's death in the family. I got to go. I go to San Francisco. They rock a cargo, my other drums, to San Francisco. And I'm the last guy they auditioned. Okay. Steve Perry's great, you know. Neil Sean, you know, they didn't really say much, you know. Michael, what's his? Kane, Jonathan Kane.
Jonathan Kane.
Michael Kane. And
Michael.
Right, yeah, Michael Kane. Blow the bloody doors off. And Randy and I hit it off great. He was so nice, and it was great playing with him. This is before Whitney Houston and all that stuff, you know. He was a studio guy living in San Francisco. Had a great haircut, too. And he was beautiful. He couldn't have been more friendly and playing-wise. So I remember it was the loudest band I ever played with in my life at the time. So I'm packing up my stuff, putting it back in the ample cases. And in walks Herbie Herbert after everybody's gone. And he says, "So what are you doing Wednesday, the next week? Can you make rehearsal?" Basically, I had the gig. And I said, I'm going to, you know, he said, "What are you doing?" He says, "Can you start Tuesday of next week?" And me, you know, their tour started 2 weeks after I got home. So I figured, well, I can rehearse for 2 weeks, you know. I says, "Well, I can't make it. I have to finish this tour with Wayne. I can't do that, you know." So I says, "Well, I got 2 weeks there. Can't we rehearse?" He goes, "You don't understand. We got production rehearsals. I didn't understand that whole thing. You know, like a month or whatever, you know, before you go into stuff. I was just like, you know, what's wrong with it? 2 weeks, we learned it. That's plenty of time, you know." So we left it at that. I said, "Well, look, you know, I guess Neil had somebody else in mind or something." I said, "But if it doesn't work out, you know, call me." I can't believe I was saying that shit, you know. Because, you know, I had a commitment to win, you know. So then it was like, it was surreal because I come off stage and, you know, they had those little security booths with the guy with the phone and everything. I mean, literally, it was something out of a movie. I'd walk off stage, good night, you know, people going nuts at these sheds. I walk off, he goes, are you Tom? They go, yeah. He goes, I have a phone call for you. And it's Steve Perry, and he's saying stuff like, how much you getting on Wayne's tour? I said this. He goes, well, we'll pay that, and we'll get, you know, and I'm thinking, well, it was very nice.
Was it a matter of honor, and like you gave your word? Was it more about that?
Well, it was kind of, I gave my word, you know, and then, but I tried to get, you know, what I did was, well, I was already booked, you know, we're in the middle of a tour.
But that's what I mean. Like, yeah, you said, you saw Wayne, you do the tour, and that's what you're doing.
Yeah, plus it's Wayne Shorter, you know? It's like, that's what I mean. Not like...
You're not telling him what's going on.
Yeah. Well, not yet. Gotcha. My story gets better. It's like, I'll just say it. You could use it or whatever. So, he says, I know we got another 3 years with you, and da-da-da-da-da, you know, and they were, you know, things were going back all anyway, I guess so. Don't put that in. Don't put that in. So, you know, Steve would keep on calling me, and I thought that was great. You know, he says, "Well, we'll buy you out of this tour, and then we'll give you this much." Oh, I could have made this. My wife to this day says you could have made. But so anyway, it came to a culmination where finally Steve agreed with me that look. Just try this guy out. I mean, if you know, he agreed with me. Look, if you get this guy and it doesn't work out, give me a call. But finally, that was in New York City, right? And oh man, Wayne's manager was threatened to sue me, even though there was no contract. And I remember that day we were playing at the Steel Pier, not Steel Pier, the Pier in New York. Outdoors. So a lot of things happened that day. And, you know, manager's threatening me. Da, da, da. So then I had a meeting with, I remember I said I had Joey Heredia on, because, I mean, he could handle that thing with his eyes closed, you know. So it's like, so I had him hanging on, you know, there yet. I didn't pull the trigger yet. I had a meeting with Wayne just before we went on. And I remember he was in this room. It was great. He was just great. He said, and he made it analogous to, I don't know if you make it analogous to this, but when he left Art Blakey's band to go with Miles, and he told me the story about how he got with Miles Davis at the time, you know. He was with Art. Somebody came down from representing Miles, and he said, Miles wants to talk to you. This is how I got the story from Wayne. It might be a different story with somebody else, or I might have this. You never know. So it ended up like, I think it was three times, and this was in New York, and he was playing with Art. Second time, blah blah blah, same thing. He goes, I can't. I'm working with. I have commitments to, Art. And apparently the third time, Miles came into this club and confronted him while he was on the bandstand saying, why don't you want to play with me? He goes, we can work that out, you know. So he was kind of, you know, comparing that to that. And basically, I guess he was saying, if you got to go, you got to go, you know. And then we had already worked it out. And then after that, we worked it out where Steve said, you know, we'll try this guy out and blah blah blah, if it doesn't work out then we'll call you or something, which didn't happen, which is fine. And then that day also Jocko, who was living with Street People, he showed up, and I had this is a prior story to that where he sat in with Chick's band and we became We became friends that day. That's another story. I got a lot of anyway, so the Jocko was there. A lot of things happened that day. Finally, I said, I'm staying to Wayne. Because, you know, we worked it out, blah, blah, blah. I can stay. But I mean, I can stay. I'm staying. Made the decision to stay. And yes, because I thought that was the right thing to do. You know, Because it also it bites you in the ass later on, you know. So
you mean if you just keep dropping gigs that you've committed to? Is that what you're saying?
Well, Wayne's gig. Yeah. You don't drop it unless...
Wayne's not going to have you back, in other words, if you...
Oh, it wasn't even that. It was just like I had committed to this legend, this guy.
I get it.
You know, and we're in the middle of a tour. I can't bail, you know, on him, you know, plus the support he'd given me.
You actually liked him, you know?
Oh, I loved Wayne. Are you kidding? He was incredible. He was just... You know, oh, we had some great times. I remember he bought a new science fiction book. I remember I was about to fall asleep, and he was over here. Psst. Hey, Tom, because he was way into science fiction, and there's a crack in the seat in front. He goes, "Hey, Tom," and he looks at me, and he shows me the cover, and he goes through the chair. He goes, "Dun dun dun, dun dun dun, dun dun dun." Oh, it was great. You know, it was just. That was just one little thing, you know. I'm going to just finish this story, and I'll tell you a good Wayne story. Great Wayne story, by the way. So anyway, you know, Wayne usually talks in analogies. You know, gets kind of cryptic a little bit. So the managers in front of me, Evelyn, my wife, and there's some other people who know Wayne that work with him a lot. And he just talked to me regular for the first time ever. And he went, "You know, Tom, sometimes they, just like I'm talking to you, sometimes they speak in analogies, sometimes they work, sometimes they don't. But I'm awfully glad you're here, you're staying, you know?" And it was like everybody, it was stopped for a second, like, I never heard him talk normal like that
direct,
before.
Direct, yeah.
Yeah. And then all of a sudden, there was a pause, he was... "Now I'm going to introduce you to my sister." He's just my sister. Like, Wayne, to make it an atlas, like, it's not that he goes that far out, but if anybody who knows Wayne, he goes like, for instance, let's say, if you said, how do you open the door? Never mind, I don't want to say that. But let's put it this way. He gets, I guess, kind of philosophical-like. To where you have to hang with it, and then you get it, and then you spew it back to him. He goes, "Yeah, that's it." Like one of the instructs he gave to me, very few, because I used to say, "Wayne, what do you want me to do?" And he'd look at me, he goes, "You know what you're doing. Like, it's up to you, you know." And then, one time we played in the North Sea, and you can see it on YouTube. We were doing this too called Endangered Species. Has this bass line, he goes, right? So there's a lot of staccato stuff going on there. So I used to play closed hi-hat real tight with Gary Willis was the bass player in the band, Mitch Foreman and myself. And so before we went on, he goes, "Hey, Tom." I go, "Yeah, Wayne." He goes, "When we play Endangered Species," he goes, "I want you to come out like King Kong." King Kong. Okay. So I opened up the hi-hat, just played like Al Foster plays, you know, like da-da-da-da-da-da. And he'd go like, and you could see him go like this. You know, he would smile and do a kind of a King Kong look and cup his hands and widen it out a little bit. And I widened it out a little bit more. And he was like, and he went, "Yeah." And then we were done. But the story I wanted to tell you about that was... One time we were playing in Berlin, and I hadn't been to Europe in a while. And Berlin is the toughest jazz audience there is, of which I had forgotten about. And Joe Zawinul was on before us, doing his solo act with. That was when you could hook up the first time you could hook up keyboards together and synchronize them. This is 1987. We used these big strips to keep going together. So Joe went on this tour to do that. And from the minute he got on stage, he was getting booed and blah, blah, blah. They were throwing airplanes on stage. And Joe, you know, like he does, he proudly bowed and everything. So Gary and I are sitting, and the tour is going great. You know, we're just getting better and better and better. And I think that's on YouTube, too, right, somewhere. But it's it's getting better and better and better. And then all of a sudden, talking and, you know, Dizzy Gillespie's there. We're hanging out with Dizzy Gillespie, the whole deal. And it's like, it's great. And Wayne comes over to me and I go, yeah, Wayne. He goes, hey, Tom. And he's looking at me like with a serious look, which he's never done before. He goes, I will go out there. I want you to dance. I want people to know that you can play before your drum solo. And he walks away. And I go, I look at Kenny and I say, what the heck was that? You know, and I never had any kind of thing like that with Wayne. So we started playing Beauty and the Beast. I don't know if you know that tune, but it goes dump, 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 da 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 dee da 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 da. It's off the Native Dancer record. And so we start playing, and it's like he's going bump, 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 and I'm playing da 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 da. And he's looking at me, he's going dance. Like that. I said, what the fuck? I'll keep you dancing, mother father. You know, it's like, and he kept on going dance, and I was like, and I'm like, and he's doing this stuff to me through the whole gig. He's pulling a Miles Davis on me. And so he's pulling a Wayne doesn't usually work like that, but it's just, that's why I say he's pulling a Miles Davis on me. So at the end of the gig, his lady friend that was with him at the time came up to us. He goes, you know what you guys just did? I said, what? He says, you just wowed. Oh, standing ovation, too, after the third tune. And then a standing ovation at the end for the band, for Wayne. So at the end of the gig, you know, we're standing in the hallway and, you know, stuff like that. We got our coats on. Really. And I'm still pissed. I'm like, what the hell just happened there, you know? So then his lady friend at the time says, you just wowed the toughest jazz audience in Europe. And then I remembered, I go, yeah, you're right. I said, you mean that's why Wayne was giving me all that crap? He goes, and he, with his little pillar, he goes, you got that right, with a big smile. And I said, I was going to kill you. He goes, yeah, I know. And then the tour manager goes, go and tell him. And he put his head right in my shoulder. He goes, you sure play a mean drumstick. And, oh, God, even now, like... And I remember I said, I was going to kill you! I'm talking to Wayne Shorter saying that, but that's how cool Wayne was. It wasn't like Wayne Shorter. It was like Tom and Wayne talking, just like with everybody else in the band. And Wayne was just like that. And now that I... And also, now that I hear him talk... In analogies like that, it is. There's a lot of wisdom in what he says, you know. At first, I was just trying to figure it out, you know. But, I mean, and I'm not trying to be hip or with or dig. Like, yeah, Wayne talks in analogies, you know. I got to be hip, so I got... But it's the truth. You listen to him talk, and it's very insightful, you know. But it's just his way of communicating. And I learned so much from him, you know. And same thing with Joe Farrell and Chick. And, that was really something. And a coda to the journey thing. You know, we're doing the summer tours in Europe, and everybody's coming up to me, congratulations on getting the journey. I said, no, 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 no. I mean, even Herbie came up to me. And introduced me to Branford Marsalis, and I said, after a gig, where were we? I can't remember. I think it was the North Sea. And Branford and Herbie were there, and I went to introduce myself to Branford, and he goes, oh, no, I know who you are. So for being with Wayne, you got a lot of, you know.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, I guess I can say this, but Herbie got wind that I might have would leave Wayne, and he said something to me that was great, and I'm going to brag on myself here because it really is something and that he did. And he says to me, Herbie goes, man, don't leave Wayne. He says, you play drums like Wayne plays the saxophone. And I was like, I started almost crying. I said Herbie, shut up. I'm saying to Herbie Hancock, shut up, you know?
Yeah.
Because he says, I've known you since you were a pup, you know, when I first started touring with Chick. And he said, but don't leave Wayne. You know, you play, you know, that's when he said that. I just, there are a lot of moments in my career that are like that, you know.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's high praise. It's really fantastic, you know what I mean? And so there you go.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. I don't, you know, when you remember that stuff, you go like, wow. You know. So those pretty much the high points of my life. And then there's the other one is B.B. King, which I can only say this. I was disenchanted with some things that were going on. Well, let's not talk about that. I don't want to talk about any negatives. You can cut that out, by the way. But I was on the road with Natalie Cole, and we were playing in Monaco. Early evening. And I knew that B.B. King was in the audience. And we had all these great, like, Sammy Nestico charts and stuff like that for the big band. And then we played everything from R&B to whatever for Natalie. That was in 19... That was in either 1999 or 2000. So I knew B.B. Oh, it was 2000, yeah. So I knew B.B. was in the audience. So I said, on all those big swing tunes, I'll play a double shuffle as the tip of the hat to him. And, you know, he probably wouldn't notice it, but I'll just do it. You know? I played, you know, this one, Beginning to See the Light, great arrangement. It goes, right? So I figured, shuffle, double shuffle. So, and there were a couple more I did like that. And the music director didn't notice, so I was cool. So at the end of the gig, I remember I was disenchanted with certain things. Certainly not with Natalie, you know. And certainly not with the band, you know. There's certain things. And I was just wondering what I was going to do. And I, you know, they had three books of her stuff, and I put them down on. I might get myself in trouble for saying this, but Jesus, like, I don't know, 20 years hence. What are you going to do, fire me? So it's like, it was fun gig. The musicians were great. So I'm putting these books away, you know, in their little fiber cases. And there are these trailers that you go in, and then there's the trailers with little hallways outdoors. So I get off the stage. I'm the last guy off the bandstand. I think everybody's gone by then. I think you can walk back to the hotel or something. And BB's waiting for me, and he's looking sharp. This is before, you know, he got, his health got worse, got bad. And he's wearing a silver seersucker suit, nice watch, smoke, sunglasses. He's looking good, you know, jewelry, looking great. And I'm just walking in, and I all of a sudden I hear, there he is! And I went like, what? Oh my God, it's BB King. He gives me this big hug, and he goes, man, you started playing that shuffle and I couldn't contain myself, you know. Then my wife calmed me down. You did it again. And I said, BB, I said, you made my life. Thank you, sir. You know, and I gave a big hug and we talked a little bit. And then I walked home. I felt great, you know. So those are the things that really, really you keep, you know. It's great.
He had to hang around and meet the guy.
I guess. I don't know. Maybe he was waiting for his wife. Maybe his wife was talking with Natalie. I have no idea. But he certainly, it was just me and him backstage. You know? Or maybe...
Getting complimented on your shuffle by B.B. King.
I know. Let me tell you. Since I've been here, I learned that there's a lot I don't know about a shuffle here. I'm telling you. I'm not being gracious. Yeah. Because they're guys that are playing their asses off that stuff, you know?
Yeah.
Just certain key things. And I just watch and listen. And that's the most important thing you can do, is watch and listen.
Right.
And play with people who can play that stuff better than you do. You know? I mean, yeah, you can study it, and it does help your stuff, but nothing's like, well... putting yourself on the firing line.
Yeah. Well, that's the Buddy Rich thing, right? Best way to get better is play gigs, right?
Yeah, I guess. I didn't know Buddy said that. That's cool.
Something like that. I mean, I'm paraphrasing.
Yeah. It's not, well, it's always good.
When I can't say it as eloquently as Buddy could.
Well, I mean, yeah. Well, it's the same thing, you know, even when I was a kid, you know, it's like, the thing that I did notice is when you play in bands, you can rehearse and rehearse and rehearse, but the shit really comes together when you play in front of people and every night, and the stuff takes on its own.
Yeah.
Takes on a life of its own. Well, you breathe life into it, but it creates something.
Yeah.
You know, and then you get better because you know how to make those certain turns. When you're allowed to take chances, or you take chances and sometimes they don't work, sometimes they do work. But you took that chance. Not too much, you don't want to annoy everybody, but you know.
Yeah.
But that's with everybody, or be able to react to somebody's whatever. What kind of feeling, or you want to change gears or make a left turn instead of a right. Now I'm talking like Wayne, you know. Or you know. You know, what kind of sauce you want on this? You know, it's right. Like, you want fried or boiled? You know?
There you go.
Or smoked.
Right.
You
know? Right.
I love food.
You know, Tom Breckline, I hate to have to call it, but yeah. Maybe we could do a part two one day.
Yeah, that'd be great.
If you're down.
Yeah, as you can see, I like to talk. Have conversations with people.
I'm really glad you agreed to this, man. I really am.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah,
and I appreciate you having me over. And I'm serious, man. Maybe we could do this again.
Oh yeah, no problem. I'm here. The comedian says I'm here all week, you know, or whatever.
I love it, man. Thank you, Tom.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks, Dave.